Thanks to DigitalOcean for sponsoring Does Not Compute. DigitalOcean is the easiest cloud platform to run and scale your applications. From effortless administration tools to robust compute, storage, and networking services, DigitalOcean provides an all-in-one cloud platform to help developers and their teams save time while running and scaling their applications. DigitalOcean offers predictable and affordable pricing so you can leave those complex pricing structures behind. With DigitalOcean, you always know what your business will pay per month with industry-leading price performance at a flat pricing structure across all global data center regions. Build your next app on DigitalOcean. Get started today with a free $100 credit at do.co/doesnot. It only takes a few minutes to get up and running. Again, that's do.co/doesnot to receive $100 towards a flexible and scalable hosting solution for your application. So this week we have bestest best and now occasional host of the show, Rockwell, with us.
Hi, guys.
Welcome to the show, Rockwell. You've all heard his name mentioned, and I think now is a good time for him to clear the air, clear his name, because I think his status has fluctuated from best friend to the show to, I can't remember what Crichton demoted you at one point, and then you guys had it out in Discord, which was pretty hilarious.
That's fair. I probably deserved it.
But yeah, welcome. I'm looking forward to having you on more often. And you see, you and I, we kind of met, I think I was SOSing in the Elixir Slack, right? I was just saying, please, someone help me. And you came to my rescue and answered some questions. And that's kind of how it started, if I'm remembering correctly.
Just to interject there, the only reason I hang out in the Elixir Slack a lot and help people just occasionally in between when I'm doing stuff. And I try to help out with easy questions because the hard questions are either usually taken or answered better by someone else. I'd helped you. I was starting to help you. And the most frustrating thing about helping people in online chat is when they don't listen to you, You give them advice and say, hey, try this. And then they ask you something completely different. They didn't even try the thing or ask any questions or try to understand the thing you're telling them. And that's so frustrating. And you were the exact opposite of that.
Yeah. So people are just kind of, they just want you to do the work for them is what I've noticed.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
So they'll kind of guide you into actually writing a usable code snippet by asking questions and then they'll go and copy and paste that. It's kind of like an interactive Stack Overflow, I guess.
Yeah. So I appreciated that.
Well, I appreciate that you appreciated that. And we, so you just kept helping me. And then I realized that you actually wrote a library that I've been using in production called Bodyguard for, it's like Pundit E. And so then I was like, oh, snap. Hey, you wrote this thing and this is awesome. And then I think that turned into like a private message. And then at some point I asked you to move into my Discord and you did. And it's been true love ever since, I guess.
I mean, that's a little heavy-handed, but I'll take it. It's been fun. And to be totally fair, you have far more experience in Elixir and Phoenix at this point than I do. So that's great. It's fun to riff on stuff with you, and we rubber duck each other all the time. So
I'll disagree with that assertion, but. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I'm excited to have you on the show. I mean, we learn a lot from each other. You have a pretty interesting job and you do a lot of different things, which I think is really cool. And also, I think that what we do overlaps a little bit. So you're doing front end, you're doing back end, you're doing DevOps stuff. But I think that your depth of experience in DevOps goes a lot deeper than mine. And that's where I like to ask a lot of questions and try to learn as much as I can in that area.
Yeah, I've been doing web apps since I guess it was Rails 2 when it came pre-installed with some version of macOS.
Okay.
I don't even remember. I don't even remember. But yeah, it was either Ruby or Rails. I think Rails was on there.
Huh.
And just started playing with it. But actually, no, I mean, that's the first time I got into modern web app development. I've been doing Cold Fusion and .NET stuff before that. Shout out Cold Fusion and Mikhail.
Well, I have a friend, my buddy Drew, I was just telling you about. He's actually just starting a junior dev job and he's going to be using Cold Fusion. So
starting a job using Cold Fusion?
Yeah.
I didn't know those jobs still existed, but that's fine. Don't at me.
He's doing design work, and don't at you. He's doing design work, and he's moving from the design department to the dev department. And the CMS that they use, I think they do a lot of stuff kind of similar to what Mikhail does for companies, like bigger companies and nonprofits and stuff. So they have a CMS that people want to use, people are used to, and it's just built in ColdFusion. So most of the actual dev work is happening in ColdFusion.
ColdFusion is still a thing.
Yeah, for quite a lot of people, I guess. But we are on the cutting edge with Elixir, and it feels good. I was talking to Paul earlier, and I feel kind of, I was talking to you too about it a little bit. We kind of feel about a little spoiled with how much power I have in being able to say we need to use X technology, and then we just use it. So I was talking to Paul earlier, and I was like, we're using our dream stack right now. We're barely using Phoenix now, because I spun up a GraphQL endpoint in DK. So we're all API based now with Phoenix and Elixir, and we're all SPA based. So we launched that thing that I've been talking about for a month. Maybe we finally launched it. It's live. Things are going pretty okay. But I was just thinking about how lucky I am to be in that position where I'm kind of like using my dream stack, all the tools that I'm interested in and I like using, that's what we're actually using.
Yeah. It feels really good to be using tools that you feel productive in and also make you happy.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
You're productive when you're happy, and actually being able to make a better product because of that is, you know, that's really what matters, right? Your code is not your business. Your business is your business. And if your tools are making that go better, then that's awesome. And it's cool, the freedom that you guys have had to adapt to use modern tools and just being able to pick the right ones, because there's so much out there now.
Yeah. I mean, hopefully we pick the right ones. I think that we have picked the ones that make us productive, and I guess that's the right decision, right?
Yeah, that's stuff I worry about a lot, is in the ever-shifting climate of modern web development, is trying to pick out the needle in the haystack. You know, what's going to be supported for a long time? What's going to get the job done? What's going to give you the fewest bugs? What has the fewest dependencies, ideally, right? Things like that.
Well, I mean, that kind of, I think about that a lot, the dependency thing, and I try to not think about how many folders are in my node modules folder right now. It's a large number. Like if you run npm install or yarn install or whatever, it usually tells you how many packages were installed. It's many thousands of them. And actually just this morning, so I mentioned that we launched the Nuxt app into production last night. And this morning we're having a problem with old versions of Safari, specifically Safari 10.1, where we're using a library called universal-url. So it's kind of like, so Elixir has the URI standard library. It's part of the standard library, working with URI, parsing URIs and working with it that way. So we're using universal URI, which in turn wraps what working group, so it's what WG-URL. And they're using, I think it was called, I just learned about this today. I didn't know that this was a thing, but they're using IDL files to build up the actual compiled source for this library. And there was a bug with another dependency of the what working group URL library, where it was building code in a way that Safari 10.1 has a bug, and that's we were running into that. So I had to fork the what working group. I had to fork that repo. Then I had to manually update dependency, push it up to our internal organization GitHub, and then change my dependency to match that to fix a relatively obscure browser bug.
You submitted a PR for that, right?
So the thing is, I could. I probably should, now that you say that. Don't put me on blast like that.
Sorry.
The thing is, the underlying bug had already been fixed. It's just that the what WG-URL library hadn't updated. It just needs to be a dependency update there. I don't know if that actually breaks anything else. It doesn't seem like it does. The test passed because I made sure to run those. But that's something I think about a lot, is dependencies, because just today I had to go and manipulate some, which makes me feel a little bit uncomfortable, because now I'm not the main maintainer of this thing. I have to manually go in and pull patches down now if there's something that gets released, like some sort of security update or bug fix or whatever. It's just more overhead, right? Something, it's more stuff to think about.
Yeah. It's nice because you know it's not going to ever change, but that's still, then you're not getting the updates like you said. And I'm pretty sure the first time I was starting to learn Node and I was trying to start up some project and I did an NPM install and just saw all the dependencies coming down one at a time. And I'm pretty sure I just looked at it and it just said, screw this, and it closed it.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not going to do this. This is ridiculous. But here we are.
Yeah. It's funny because on Twitter, I see people that are early web devs. They're other, you know, I follow a game developer and he was doing something with NPM and he was like, this is nuts. He was basically saying the same thing. I think he somehow got NPM to brick itself when he was installing, he was trying to have NPM update itself and it just bricked itself.
That sounds about right.
And so he was just kind of raging about that on Twitter. But yeah, it's, I don't know, it's something I've been thinking about a little bit because there are so many. And it's funny because when I started, okay, so I was like, okay, well, I have to fork this because I'm not seeing any sort of solutions. There's not really a polyfill. It's a pretty obscure bug that only affects a certain number of Safari versions. It just so happens that we actually have most of our users, I think, actually run Safari, which is interesting, right?
Yeah, wow.
And so we have a number of users that are running Safari 10 point, because you know that I checked it. I was like, do we need to worry about this? And then I figured out we did. And so I was like, okay, what next? I Googled for a while. I looked through the GitHub repos. Every issue that talked about it was just kind of dead-ended, except for I happened to see, you know how when you have comments in GitHub and in between there's like a commit that references that issue sometimes? So I happened to see that someone actually pushed a fix in the dependency repo, and that's how I figured out, oh, I just need to clone, or I need to fork this and then update the dependency to fix it. But it took a while for me to even just arrive. So it stole like a couple hours from me to have to do this whole ordeal.
Yeah, that's the worst. The one line commits with the 5-paragraph explanation.
Yeah.
Of why it's an issue.
Yeah. It's a whole thing. But there's other things too. So like we launched it. It's looking good. I mean, we're doing the front end on Heroku. So
tell me about this. So how did it go? You deployed this last night as of recording.
Yes. Yeah. Last night.
And you literally just flipped the DNS over and it was good to go.
Yeah, well, mostly, yeah. So it was good to go because we didn't have any downtime. That's the biggest thing, right? Like there was nothing that went wrong, nothing broke. So what I did was this whole time for this whole month, I kind of broke off our production server and kind of put it on its own island. So it was just kind of living in our Heroku just by itself. And if I needed to deploy a hotfix to it, I just had it auto-deploy from a very specific branch. And so then what I did was I actually spun up new production servers and staging servers and put those into a pipeline. So we have the API pipeline on Heroku and we have the web pipeline on Heroku. And so
what's a pipeline? Is that like a stack?
Yeah, it's like a way of organizing your applications. So you can actually promote them within pipelines. So when you push to Heroku, it creates a slug. So it does all the compilation. It creates basically what would be living on a server if you were hosting it yourself, what you would ever actually FTP up to the server. So it creates the slug. And then if everything checks out on staging, you can actually click a button and it will just copy that slug from staging to production. So sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't. In the case of, say, like a Nuxt app, you actually need to have it recompile because your environment variables might be different on staging and production. That's a pretty big deal. So you actually have to, you can't actually do the promote thing because the promote thing takes like 20 seconds. You push a button and you've promoted something from staging to production in 20 seconds, right? So it just goes live. So anyway, we have the web pipeline. And so it's just like a way to organize your apps so you can see the different servers in different environments. So for example, we actually do custom domains for stores now. And that means that we have the regular DK Nuxt app, which is really just an Express app. And then we have a custom app for store custom sites. So if you had rockwellswares.com and you wanted your Design Collective store to be served at your domain, you can do that. And how that works, it's like a little subset of an app, like our full DK app. And so that's a separate Heroku server. And so how it works now with the pipeline is we push to develop and both the DK app and the store app are deployed at the same time. And you merge into master and both the production apps are deployed at the same time. So it's kind of in sync. But anyway, the whole month we kind of like move the production server away, just like so we wouldn't accidentally merge something into it and just break stuff. But that means that our development flow and our servers have been up for a month. So we've had plenty of time to test things. We have plenty of time to make sure things are configured correctly, building properly. So when it came time to actually make it live, I logged into, actually, no, I didn't even have to change anything at Cloudflare. I removed a custom domain off of one Heroku app and just added it to another one. And it was literally 20 seconds and it was a it was serving the new app.
That's good. I mean, that's months of planning coming down to a single click, literally, and having it all work out. That's pretty surreal.
It was crazy because anytime it's funny because like I know that I have automated backups running and I have like a, you know, on Heroku, I could just go in and give it a timestamp and it'll roll back my DB to that timestamp.
Yeah.
But I still get nervous. My hands still sweat. My heartbeat still goes crazy. So I was like, Paul was like, what do you want me to do to help? And I didn't want to say, you do it. You know? So I did it, and yeah, it went pretty well. So the only thing that we've had happening is some sort of a memory leak, which happens occasionally. And so
you were sending me some graphs here; they look pretty pretty scary.
Yeah. So Elixir is totally fine. The API is fine.
Of course,
the RAM usage is great. Response times are great. It's, you know, it's been live anyway for a while, but we've had some sort of memory leak, and I've been Googling that. And basically, what I did, and I've done this for Ruby before too, and I'm sure you probably have as well, but basically you use some sort of tool to monitor a process. And if it's been around for too long, or if it's using too much RAM, you just kill it and start a new one. And that's what we're doing. So if a process starts to gobble up too much memory, we just kill it and start a new one.
That is one strategy. I actually had that done to me forcefully once. Before I really understood quite how RAM hungry web applications could be. I was hosting on Dreamhost, which was a shared hosting environment where you're literally just logged into a Linux box with a bunch of other people. You can see who they are and what they're running, and you know, it's not a VM where it's your box. It's someone else's box that you're logged into, right?
Right.
And yeah, I quickly learned that they would kill your process if it started taking up too much RAM, and I couldn't figure out why I was getting at least 500 errors, and that's when I learned about the limitations of shared hosting. They would literally just force it, just kill it.
They didn't even restart the process. They just killed it.
Yeah.
That's crazy. So that's funny. It's not funny. That's crazy. I mean, Heroku, kind of what they do is if you go over a certain threshold, I think it's like 200% or something, they'll just restart the dyno. So at least they restart it for you. So your app comes back up.
Mm-hmm.
But it's running like that. And Paul and I were up late last night, and we both opened like 12 different tabs to the homepage and just refreshed them in cycles to see what we could do. And it's stable. So after kind of implementing that sort of hack, I guess, we're actually using a library called, I'm going to have to put it in the show notes now, I can't remember it. But I found it in the GitHub comments, actually. People were having a discussion about it, and some guy was like, oh, I wrote this to solve my problem, so that's what I'm using. But after using it, we have multiple dynos. And so if the process gets killed, that means that people behind it aren't going to get timeouts, and they're not going to get errors while the process comes back up, because we're running multiple workers and multiple dynos. So it's pretty seamless. Like, I haven't been able to trigger a timeout myself. I haven't been able to trigger like an app error myself by load testing a whole bunch. So I'm feeling cautiously optimistic about it.
Sure. You got to do what you got to do, man.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you got to start somewhere, right? I mean, now we can start trimming it down. I think I've talked in a few other episodes where because the app was mostly server rendered for a while, and we started bolting an API onto it, there's like a lot of endpoints that are doing things that they don't need to be doing. So for example, like you might have a sale, and the sale, when you're listing sales, the product might be nested in the response. So it's not that big a deal if it's not all being serialized. It becomes a much bigger deal if you're serializing all of that. It turns out when you have JSON coming over the pipeline, it's going to chunk all that and keep it in RAM for a minute, and that causes some problems. So there's like places that we need to clean up here and there, which is fine. But now we're at least at the point where, hey, it works fine. Actually, response times are great. And we're not having errors, and we're not running out of RAM anymore, having forceful resets.
This blew my mind a little bit. The Phoenix API app is just a single instance. You're not even load balancing that yet.
Yeah.
Maybe I shouldn't say that publicly. You're going to get DDoSed or something.
They can try. I got Cloudflare on my side. So that's actually changing very soon. And that's kind of a, I don't want to say a limitation. So we're using Quantum to run and schedule our jobs. And the whole idea of OTP is that you have a cluster, you have a cluster of nodes, and they can kind of talk to each other. So you have data being shared between the nodes, and if the nodes can talk to each other, then OTP and Quantum can kind of orchestrate, okay, you're doing this job and you're doing that job, so we're not going to duplicate up on them, right? But with Heroku, since you don't really have nodes that can communicate with each other, for every dyno we spun up, we'd have the job server, like the jobs would just be running again. So obviously I can make an umbrella app and then have a separate web server that only runs the jobs. I could do that. I just haven't had time to. But really, I think what the Heroku way to do it is use the worker. So you use a thing called a proc file, which is a process file. And so basically when Heroku starts your app, it looks at the proc file and you say web run this command, worker run this command. So what I'm doing, or I'm going to be doing, is I'm just going to make a separate mix task that only starts up the Quantum scheduler. So on the web process, I can say, okay, go ahead and start Phoenix. And on the worker process, I can say, go ahead and start Quantum. And so that way I can actually have multiple web dynos and they won't trigger duplicate job sends.
So it'll be a long running mix task. That's just running in the foreground and running the scheduler. That's cool. That totally makes sense.
Pretty much. Yeah. Yeah. It really just runs gen servers. And so another kind of, again, I'd say pitfall. I don't mean a bad thing. It's just, it's not necessarily how OTP was designed to work. So Quantum, I mean, it's running on gen servers, right? So it's got its own process that schedules the jobs and all this stuff. So basically it's like a cron-like syntax. So you say every X minutes, run this task, and it'll just do that, right? But the problem is that, every time you deploy an app, the dyno restarts. So if you have, say, 10,000 emails sending and then the dyno restarts, well, those are gone. You're going to have to somehow figure out how to reschedule those. And I think Heroku actually restarts all the dynos every day. So there's like a daily restart. So that's kind of out the window. We can't really rely on in-memory stores for jobs like ETS or anything like that. So we're actually using Redis. So Quantum runs the task. The task that runs puts all the jobs into Redis, and then Quantum, I'm pretty sure you can actually say like, yeah, use Redis for this. And then, we're using XQ. So Quantum puts the jobs in Redis from the test that's being run, and then XQ connects to Redis and just does the jobs. It's kind of like a weird, really, we're just using Quantum for cron.
Oh, really? Okay. I was just saying that might be an option. Just have a mixed task that just does the one thing, one shot, and just use the Heroku scheduler. That's what I do for my application, is I just have rake tasks that nightly billing, send out emails, sync up various services, and I just have my provider Cloud 66 just runs those on intervals, and that seems to work okay.
Yeah, I did that. So for Rails, I did that for a while. I used the Heroku scheduler, and I actually used a little hack where you could use bash conditionals. So you just write a little bash conditional. If the day is Tuesday, then you paste it. You actually paste the bash in the text input, because it's like you click add a new one and it's just a text input, right? So you say, if today is Tuesday, then run this this Rails task, this what's it called, rake. You run the rake task. And so that's what I was doing. And I could do that again, but I was like, this is just better. Not better, it's less error prone, because I can test it. I can test it locally. It's just, I don't know, it feels more, not robust, it feels safer to do it that way, I guess. But yeah, so that's what we're doing. We're step by step, we're getting kind of like out the door of Heroku for our Elixir app. We're going to keep our front end stuff there because I like Heroku quite a bit, but we want to take advantage of OTP and all that stuff. Basically all the things that you're doing that I can't right now, hot reloading and all that.
Yeah. Once you actually start being able to use the stuff that makes Phoenix so cool, you're going to want to have a real cluster, right? WebSockets, PubSub, all that stuff. So I know you were looking into the DevOps stuff with Doku and all that. So, but like you said, one step at a time, right?
Yeah, one step at a time. And I mean, like I said, I don't have a ton of experience there, so I rely on you a lot for that. That's why I'm always bothering you in Discord. But it just sounds so nice. I mean, so you're like, yeah, I have, so you're showing me all these nice monitoring tools, and Heroku has some monitoring tools, but they're almost about as simple as it gets. And that's fine for what I need now, but I have a little bit of envious eyes whenever you're showing me screenshots and you're like,
can you remote console into your running Elixir application?
I believe so, yeah.
Is that possible? So I'll show you this later. I'll put in the show notes, observer_CLI. So if you use the observer in Elixir at all, technically it's an Erlang thing. So you just do, it's :observer.start. I know syntax. And it starts a little GUI application on your just shows a window, and it allows you, it has different tabs, so you can see every single process it's running. You can see what the state of all the processes are. You can see the message queues on each process and where everything's backed up. You know, if how long the queue is.
That's crazy.
There's all these really, really cool diagnostic utilities. And because it runs as a native window, it's a pain to set up remotely because you have to set up an SSH tunnel with forwarding, and you have to set up a local node that has the same cookie as the remote nodes. By cookie, I mean an Erlang node cookie. It's just a little shared secret, basically, so they know they can connect to each other.
Okay.
And you need to set the host name, and there's all these requirements, and I just could not get it to work, especially when you're behind some like Heroku, where who knows what firewalls and stuff you're going through, right, with opening ports and who knows. So Observer CLI, you just add it as a dependency, fire up a remote console into your running application, and then Observer CLI start, and you get that same interface, but in the terminal.
That's what? Like in the terminal. So you can, it's kind of like HTOP or something.
It's, yeah, exactly. Like a curses-based thing looks like that.
Gotcha.
And it has all different tabs, lists all your processes, how much memory they're using, and so on. It allows you to dig in pretty deep. And that's been a huge, awesomely useful tool for me for debugging stuff in production.
I'm going to have to check that out. I'm definitely going to have to check that out. So, I mean, there's some work to do. It's kind of like when I first inherited the Rails app, there was some work to do around cleaning things up and making sure that everything was just, you know, above board and working well. And we're, you know, making sure we weren't sending like huge payloads of data over the wire. I'm hesitant to like, so I have this weird thing where I'm like looking to GraphQL where this is my savior. It's going to make all my problems go away. You know, the client can describe the data interface, like the data that it needs, and we'll just send it that. And I'll just be like sipping my coffee with my feet up in the air, you know, something like, it's kind of like the grass is always greener idea, I guess. So I'm like a little bit more optimistic than cautiously optimistic about GraphQL, but I've already kind of started on it. And so like actually something you kind of inspired me to get that ball rolling because you said something to me. I think that you were saying something about what Ben Wilson, one of the maintainers, creators of Absinthe, which is the GraphQL implementation in Elixir, he was saying like, oh, you don't need all this stuff. You can actually just manually fire queries from your controller to your Absinthe installation. And you were freaking out about it to me. And then I started freaking out about it. So that's what I'm kind of starting to work on now is generally like getting the ball rolling. So like our homepage has tons of different types of data. It hits like 7-8 different tables, right? So we're having to do all these joins and all this stuff. And right now it's quite a bit of data. And so I'm like, that's a perfect place to implement GraphQL because that's exactly the problem it sort of solves.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially when you have so many different types of queries, different parameters, right? What's my zip code? Just from the client, request, it's, you know, what store am I visiting? What's, you know, what are my filters?
Yeah.
All that stuff is, I think that's going to be a big win.
It's just a lot of stuff. And I think another example is a receipt because receipts have so much information regarding like a customer, a store, line items, the product belonging to the line items, shipping options, the chosen shipping option, the payment method. And it has to kind of all show in the same spot. And it just becomes a whole lot. So, I mean, like back in the day, it's weird to say that now, maybe like last year, you actually pair programmed with me And you gave me an idea. You're like, oh, just make a struct that can make a receipt struct. And I was like, oh my goodness. I don't know why I didn't think of that. And so I did. And we've been using it ever since. It's been awesome. But it's like a pretty intense thing when you look at the actual implementation because it's pulling and preloading all this data.
Yeah. So you're basically doing what the GraphQL endpoint is going to be doing eventually, right?
Yeah. 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 I'm looking forward to it. I'm really, and WebSockets.
Well, yeah. Well, so the interesting thing about GraphQL is once you add it to your application, suddenly your application becomes, it almost like becomes like your application is just a database.
Yeah.
Like there's nothing to it. You're literally just querying your own database and there's obviously set rules and business logic behind it. But you start to lose the line is blurred between, okay, this is an application, I have to call it versus, hey, just give me this data. Mm-hmm. It's a weird shift where suddenly it doesn't feel really like your server thing is the application, right? It feels like your client is the application. I don't know. It's kind of a nebulous idea, but
sure.
You know what I'm saying? It's once you have a query language that is flexible like that and just becomes a straight pipeline into your data to get it in, get the data and get out.
Yeah.
That's...
Well, you're kind of moving a concern from the controllers to the client side, right? Because, yeah, the client sends parameters to your API. So the client will say, order by created at ascending and filter by name that matches this and include things that have this tag, right? So it might send like an array of IDs or it might send an ID or a string or something like that. But there's a part of... You know, for me, it's actually in our context. We also have functions that accept parameters and actually map over the parameters and then construct a query. But it's kind of like partially taking that and moving it over to the client side. So obviously, the server API is still actually doing the SQL queries and doing all the filtering. But it feels like you're moving like a piece of glue in between them, if that means anything.
Well, sure. So if with MVC, Model View Controller, right, in the old, let's call it old, in the past, previous way you're doing it, the controller sits between the model and the view, right? And traditionally, your view is just a server-rendered page, and your model is some back-end data store, and their controller is, like you said, the glue that's in between them. Well, now, your view is literally view, V-U-E. Your model is actually now your GraphQL endpoint.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
And your controller is now somewhere in the middle there. And where else is that going to live? It's going to be in your client.
Yeah.
So you can kind of think of it that way. I mean, GraphQL resolvers are kind of technically, you're supposed to think of them like controllers. But again, getting into the mindset of GraphQL is it's a query language, right? It's designed for fetching and mutating data. So that's, and now you've got all the state, now you've got all the state that's sitting in your view.
Yeah.
Right. That you have to deal with. And then you have to have business logic to deal with that. So that's kind of a controllery thing to do. So,
yeah. Well, it's interesting because something that just dawned on me when you were saying that is, so when you say model, because I learned how to build apps via Rails, I think of a Rails model. And to this day, I still think of a Rails model, that idea of like a class. This is where everything lives, right? For this thing. And now it's different because when you're building like a REST API, you're still working with that idea of a model because you have to, you know, there's like JSON schema and things where you can say, oh, get a post, but also include the authors, right? So you're getting multiple pieces of data. There are multiple models represented in that one response. But with GraphQL, it's totally, it's like your model is the query that you build, right? Because now you almost have access, as long as the relationships are defined in GraphQL, as long as you have access to query that stuff, your model can almost be any shape.
Yeah, and even Absinthe, and I think even GraphQL just literally calls them schemas, right?
Yeah, I guess that's true. That's, I don't know why that was such a, just that was just a very transformational moment for, is transformational a word? It's a very transformational moment for me just then.
I'm glad we have these talks.
Yeah. I'm glad that we can talk to them in person. Like, because this would be taking place in Discord and we'd be typing to each other. You'll type at me for a while and then I won't say anything for a while and then I'll type at you for a while. And then it's like we're playing tennis with blobs of text.
And then it scrolls up forever and it's gone.
Yeah. So are you actually using GraphQL? Like, I think you said you were using GraphQL in production, right?
No, it's not in production yet. I've been building a new piece of our application, and I actually just finished turning all the REST APIs into GraphQL endpoints, at least the ones that I had implemented so far.
Yeah.
And that's about as far as I got. And I think I implemented one or two different subscriptions, and it's been a while since I've actually looked at that, so I don't remember all the details. But yeah, it's I have very, very limited experience with it, but I did enjoy what I was able to do. In fact, I wasn't even doing anything fancy on the client side. I was just happy to have GraphQL to work with. On the client side, I'm literally just concatenating strings to build GraphQL queries. I'm not using any fancy Apollo or anything. I'm still just using plain old HTTP requests, using Axios, and just posting and getting and whatever.
Sure.
But and just parsing the data. And I just basically took all the client-side API code and just replaced it one function at a time with these GraphQL calls. And
so, I mean, what do you think the business value of all this stuff is? Because that's something I try to be conscious of all the time. Like, am I making, especially as a CTO? So, I mean, what is actually your official title with RHR?
Technically, I'm CTO. I mean, I it's full stack. I do everything from the DevOps to development to everything. I'm the sole developer.
Yeah. Okay.
So
that, like, as a CTO, I'm trying to figure out, okay, how can I maximize keeping Paul happy and keeping myself happy, but also maximize keeping my boss's pocketbook happy and the bottom line happy. And I don't, it's this weird kind of zone that I'm walking in. It could just because of my Twitter feed. I don't know if I'm following a certain type of person, but I feel like there's almost a level of guilt that comes with me thinking about, oh man, GraphQL sounds amazing and it'll make my life a lot easier. And I think that's where that weird kind of guilt, like, do I really need this to help? Does this help the business really? You know, does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. It's something that you should struggle with,
yeah.
Right? You don't want to be chasing every rabbit
right
down the hole, because you'll never get anything done. And so in this particular case, it's hard to say. It depends on how much you have done already, right? And really what value is it going to give you? I mean, performance-wise, it's you have no performance issues right now. You could scale forever probably and be fine for a long time,
yeah.
Right? GraphQL does have that ability. You know, you will get those memory improvements. Your clients will be maybe a little lighter, a little snappier in terms of, you know, the actual tab that's open and
okay,
what data's in there. And but it does open the ability for other options, you know, standalone clients that just are like one-off, you know, special purpose things. So obviously,
yeah,
right? Because they can just use the endpoints that they need to. Native apps, obviously, that's going to be huge on a mobile device where you're memory constrained and resource constrained. That's why Facebook created GraphQL, right? They saw that need, right? That's definitely a value add. Again, I don't know if this stuff is on your roadmap or whatever, but
it's funny because it is.
Okay, well, there you go. So taking notes. What else? I mean, there's lots of advantages, and just developer happiness, that's worth something, right?
I mean, yeah, I think so, right? Because thinking about a turnover, like productivity too, you think about productivity, and it's interesting because I think about, okay, if managing an API becomes a little bit simpler, that means that maybe I can be more productive. That means that we can put off hiring somebody a little bit longer. Maybe that's a little bit naive and optimistic thinking. But really, like, if you think about a startup, one of the big, besides maybe office space and real estate, one of the biggest expenses is salary, because my salary is way more than what we pay in server costs, you know?
Right.
So I think there's some sort of value there. Again, maybe it's naive to say, because I have never really run a large company, but it seems to me like if we can adopt these tools that make me individually more productive each day and other people more individually more productive each day, that means that I'm helping the bottom line, which is really the most important thing, I guess, because if there's not a bottom line, I don't have a job.
Yeah. And then it's just crunching the numbers, sort of. I mean, you can't probably put a hard number on it, but you got to just figure out how much time it's going to take to get there. And then think about over time, how much time is that going to save you?
Yeah.
And it might not even just be pure production time, right? You also have to keep in mind supporting, you know, the cost of supporting an API that maybe doesn't do exactly what you want. You have to keep in mind, you know, trade-offs you might have to make. You might have to develop around limitations of the API, right? On the client side, that's going to take time.
Yeah.
That's going to take resources. So there's a lot to think about, right? How many controllers do you have? How many API controllers do you know off the top of your head?
Off the top of my head, I don't, but it's really not that much. When
is it like less than 20, less than 50?
Oh, less than 50 for sure. I would say between 10 and 20.
Yeah. That's
actually, now that I think about it, we can delete most of them because we're API only now. So I would say probably 10, 12, maybe 15 at the most.
Why are we still talking? Why aren't you doing this right now?
Because I'm disciplining myself. I worked much too late. I worked until 1. Paul and I were just like debugging the RAM issues until around 1. We're poking the beehive with sticks, more or less. And so I didn't really get much sleep. And then I was up today, fixed a couple of bugs, just monitoring things, making sure nothing breaks, you know. So I'm pretty tired right now. Actually, very tired.
I was just giving you a hard time. I wasn't actually suggesting that, but
you knew what that would do to me. I don't know. I already started. I have a branch going, and I want to keep part of my week for exploring things, because I think that's part of what my job as CTO is, like exploring what we should be doing. Are there new tools that will make our jobs easier, make our lives easier, affect the bottom line? I think that's part of it, is the research phase and the testing phase. And so I'm trying to earmark an hour a day, half an hour every morning, just to check in on stuff, read up on GraphQL, make a couple of new reducers or something and see how it feels.
Yeah, definitely. Don't forget to look at the testing piece too, because that will be, you know, if you're already in there rewriting things, you might as well rewrite all the tests to support it, so you know you're doing it right.
That's a great reminder. Yeah, I have some controller tests. The context, the actual business logic is pretty heavily tested, but the controllers are not. So it could be a good time to jump in and do that. It's a good reminder.
I honestly think you're gonna do one or two of these absinthe schemas, and you're just gonna not want to go back. Just bang them out, and it'll be good. I promise you that.
That's a promise. Everyone heard it just now.
It's a double-edged sword, isn't it?
Yeah.
This podcasting thing.
Well, now you've got me all excited about GraphQL. I need to actually go take a nap before I do anything else. But
sounds like a good idea.
Yeah. But I'll talk to you later.
All right. This is great talk, man. See you later.
Thanks to DigitalOcean for sponsoring Does Not Compute. Build your next app on DigitalOcean. Get started today with a free $100 credit at do.co/doesnot. It only takes a few minutes to get up and running. Again, that's do.co/doesnot to receive $100 towards a flexible and scalable hosting solution for your application.